Our Bible reading this evening is taken from the Old Testament, where we will be thinking this evening of the next installment in our study in the life of Elisha. We're going to be thinking this evening from, and reading this evening from 2 Kings chapter 5, and I'm going to invite George Barney, one of our elders, to come forward and to read these words for us.
Reading from 2 Kings chapter 5. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you, so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message: "Why have you torn your robes? Make the man come to me and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a message to say to him, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored and you will be cleansed." But Naaman went away angry and thought and said, "I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and went off in a rage. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, 'Wash and be cleansed'?" So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant." The prophet answered, "As surely as the Lord lives whom I serve, I will not accept a thing." And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. "If you will not," said Naaman, "please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing when my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm, and I have to bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this." "Go in peace," Elisha said. After Naaman had traveled some distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, My master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him. So Gehazi hurried after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running towards him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. Is everything all right? He asked. Everything is all right, Gehazi answered. My master sent me to say, two young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two sets of clothing. By all means, take two talents, said Naaman. He urged Gehazi to accept them, and then tied up the two talents of silver in two bags with two sets of clothing. He gave them to two of his servants, and they carried them ahead of Gehazi. When Gehazi came to the hill, he took the things from the servants and put them away in the house. He sent the men away, and they left. When he went in and stood before his master, Elisha asked him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" "Your servant didn't go anywhere," Gehazi answered. But Elisha said to him, "Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to take money or to accept clothes, or olive groves and vineyards, or flocks and herds, or male and female slaves? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever." Then Gehazi went from Elisha's presence, and his skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow. Amen.
Let me invite you to take your Bibles and have them open at 2 Kings chapter 5 this evening. 2 Kings chapter 5, one of the most spectacular accounts of God's miraculous power that we have in the Old Testament. This is going to be our focus this evening. It must have been terrifying for that young girl. She would no doubt have probably overheard the grown-ups in her house speaking about what was happening in nearby villages. News filters quickly, especially when it's bad news, doesn't it? And so she would ask, as young kids do, she would ask what the grown-ups are talking about, and they would very calmly reassure her and say, God knows what he's doing. And then, was it the next day, maybe the day after, the unthinkable happened. The armies that had caused carnage in these villages just along the road reached their village. And for her, if you'd asked her, it was almost as if it's a bit of a blur now, because she remembers just being picked up, and she remembers screaming for her mum and dad, but they weren't there, and she didn't know where they were. And by the time the blurring stopped, she was tied up and she was headed away from everything that she'd known. She was tied up and headed away by people who were speaking a language she didn't quite understand. And the only thing that she could hold on to was these words she'd heard repeated so often: God knows what he's doing. And so she kept repeating and holding that in her mind: God knows what she's doing. And hold on to these words is exactly what she did. Because when we meet her in 2 Kings chapter 5, by this time she's now been in this foreign land. She's a slave. She happens to be the slave of the wife of the commander-in-chief of the Syrian army. But she's one who has not forgotten where she's come from. I suppose for her, she could have ended up in worse locations. She could have ended up in worse conditions. But she ends up in the conditions here where the commander-in-chief, her boss's husband, is now ill, gravely ill, seriously ill. And I want you to notice straight away this evening what she doesn't do. She does not gloat in that illness. She's not smiling and says, "Well, what goes around comes around. You orchestrated this whole campaign, and now you're getting your comeuppance from God." Maybe she didn't know about the word karma that often gets thrown about in conversation, but that's not what she does, is it? Because her heart is different. Our heart mirrors in many ways the heart of Daniel in Babylon, or the heart of Mordecai under the reign of King Xerxes, or the heart of Ezra and Nehemiah, seeking the physical and the spiritual good of her captors. Because for her, it was time. It was time to somehow communicate, because she'd heard all about this illness and the worry and the concern, and she knew that there was trouble. But now it was time. It was time to speak about God. It was time to speak of the God who knows what he's doing. And so she comes and says in verse 3, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." So this young girl not simply had understood that God knows what he's doing, but she'd also understood that there was a prophet in the land. And these details give to us the prompter that she would likely have come from the remnant of believers in that particular generation. We saw the last time when we studied the life of Elisha that being a believer, however, doesn't insulate us from some of the difficulties of life. At the end of the previous chapter, in chapter 4 in verse 38, we're reminded that the believers, that they too were caught up with the impact of the famine in that land. And for this little girl, she would be able to say that yes, she and her family, as part of the family of faith, they were caught up in the troubles of the land. They were caught up in that war. And yet, she, from this family, or part of the remnant, part of the minority who still held to the truth of God. She had parents and possibly grandparents who made sure that this girl knew what she needed to know for life and for death. Because this girl was going to be taught that irrespective of what she may learn in this world, and irrespective of how useful some of that information might be, the crucial information that she needs to know is the information about God. That God knows what he's doing, and that he is a God who communicates through his prophets in that generation, through his word in this generation. And I suppose immediately we have a reminder, don't we? The reminder of the obligation as parents and as grandparents and as family members to ensure that whatever our children and grandchildren and family learn, that they learn about God, that they learn that God knows what he's doing, that they learn that God is communicating to us. Because whatever academic knowledge may be accrued, or whatever practical knowledge might be accrued over the years, the knowledge that's going to keep our kids in life and through death and into eternity is a knowledge of God. It's quite ironic that in a generation as ours, and even at times within the confines of the wider church, we prepare our kids for life, but we're so hesitant to prepare our kids for death. And it is our responsibility as parents, as grandparents, as family, to communicate, to ensure that the information that our kids know is that they know about God. They know about the God who's in control, the God who communicates, the God who calls us to follow. And so there is that reminder that instantly comes from a passage like this, as well as the reminder that the witness, the faithful witness to God can come from the most unlikely sources, and yet be used by God in a remarkable way. Because here was a slave girl in a foreign land, and possibly orphaned by this point. And even though she was a slave girl, she was free, because she was living in a relationship with a God whom she could trust, because that God was in control of all things. And so what we see here and are reminded of here, as we maybe take a step back, is that we're reminded of the God who is in control, who does know what he's doing in the big things and in the small things. I want you for a moment to think of verse 1 here, where we're reminded about what God has done. Notice here this very unusual detail about this great commander-in-chief. He had been used by the Lord to gain a victory against the Lord's people. And you think, well, that's rather odd, isn't it? And yes, it is, and it isn't. Because the nations of the world were being used by God at times to teach God's people the lessons of how they've abandoned God and how they need to come back under the protection and welfare that God gives. And so in the big details of life, we're reminded that God is not a localized deity, that he's surrounded by a national border or perhaps a border of language. But we're being reminded that the earth is the Lord's, the entirety of it. That God is the God of Israel, the covenant-keeping God of Israel, but he's also the God of all the nations of the world. And he can use whoever, whether it is someone of faith or someone who is hostile, to accomplish his purposes. Because he is God of the big issues of life. And yet he's also, in verse 2, he's God of the comparatively smaller issues in life, where we've got the reminder here that the band of raiders had gone out and taken captive this young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. And so you've got the big pictures, as it were, the international political situation, as it were, and yet you also have individual circumstances. You've got world affairs, and you've got personal dilemmas, and you've got the same powerful God who is in control of all of them. And so you've got our God who is the big picture God, and also our God is involved in the very minor details of our life. And so it wouldn't take someone who is particularly pastorally minded to see the application tonight, that I'm pretty sure that there's a good number of us in here tonight who need to be reminded that not simply is God in control of the international affairs, but God is in control of the individual circumstances of your life and of my life. There is nothing unfolding tonight in your life. There's no detail yet to happen or that is happening or has happened that God does not know and that God is not using for his purposes to ultimately do you as one of his people good. And the reminder of that this evening is good for us to be aware of. God knows what he's doing. He's in control. And so, thinking about this young girl who witnessed to this family is our starting point for this chapter this evening. And what I want to do now is I want to begin thinking about Naaman, this great leader, and to see something of his journey to faith. And to recognize within the details that are given to us in God's word that while his journey was specific and personal, there are general principles through what he went through that apply to your life and to my life tonight. And so we begin thinking of this decorated, brave commander. This is probably the commander that the soldier that people would think of when they thought of the Syrian army. He probably had a stature similar to what General Montgomery had in the UK following World War II, or Stormin' Norman Schwarzkopf, for those of you who are old enough to remember that name from the war in Iraq in the 1990s. He was the figurehead, as it were, of a successful military career. He had influence. He had prestige. In many ways, he was living the good life, far away from the battlefield. He was now enjoying the best that Syria, that beautiful country, could offer. And everything is going swimmingly for this man with regard to the prestige that he has, the influence, the wealth that he has access to, until that diagnosis comes out of the blue. And his skin starts playing up. And, you know, he's perhaps, no, maybe not that different from the rest of us. And we dismiss initially, think, oh, well, it'll be fine. It'll be fine a day or two. And then a day or two comes and you realize, no, there's a serious problem here. This needs to get addressed. And even although he is this decorated hero underneath that uniform, he has got the skin now of a leper. And the lowest slave in Syria would not choose to swap places with this highest ranking commander for anything because of the situation that he is now in. This diagnosis, it's come out of the blue, but it's going to be used by God as the first step to humbling this man, to bring him to a position where he might actually know the deeper healing that he needs, that goes beyond the mere skin level, but the deeper healing of his soul. And that first step is the reminder of his frailty, of his mortality. This unexpected diagnosis that's come into his life that just rocks him. And step one in this humbling process for this man Naaman is this diagnosis that comes to him. Step two, I want you to use your imagination. I want you to try and put yourself into the mind of Naaman as he's traveling to, as far as he's concerned, the God-forsaken country of Israel. The place that he thought he'd never have to see, and hoped he'd never have to see again. Last time he was there for conflict, for war. And the images of conflict and warfare are there in his mind. And now he can't quite actually believe he is deliberately making his way back there. And the reason he's making his way back there was because the consultants of their day, while being very sympathetic, they could offer him absolutely nothing. And they looked at him and they explained to him his symptoms and they explained what's likely to happen. And they were very sympathetic, but there was nothing they could do. And the lunacy almost of his situation as he thinks about it, as he's trudging his way to this God-forsaken country, as he thinks, the lunacy of it is that he's going here on the basis of this slight news that was given to him by a slave girl. And he's trying to think, well, if somebody had explained their situations, well, a slave girl from a foreign country has told me that in this other country there's a prophet who might be able to help. And you'd be looking at him, you're grasping at straws, mate, aren't you? Really, you think that's gonna do anything? And that's what he is. Step two, he's going to, in many ways, the last place on earth he would want to be going to. The place that he would have dismissed and despised, and he ends up. That's the very direction he has to head into. And it's actually not that dissimilar in many ways when on a spiritual level we begin to be woken up by God. And whether it is God gets our attention through a diagnosis or through a bereavement or through an accident or through whatever set of circumstances that begin to rock our security, the place that had been dismissed for many, many years for some of us as the church is actually the place we end up going to. And you're going to the church? What on earth are you going to go to the church for? What are they going to say to you? And yet, that's the place that the message of a God who communicates is to be found. So step two is his trudging, reluctantly, grasping at straws to try and get well again, going to a foreign country. Step three in the process that God uses to humble this very proud man was as he arrives as a royal dignitary to the king of Israel, as he arrives in the kind of palace, as it were, very different to our palaces, but to the abode of the king, he comes with all of the paraphernalia of a conquering nation, and he delivers the message. And the king has a very different reaction to the little girl, because the king's reaction is one of a complete godless understanding in many ways of the power of God and the God who does communicate, unlike this little girl. But he's very cordially escorted from the king's presence, and he's put into a side room. But he hears the commotion as the king is shouting and bawling and in ripping his clothes and thinking it's some kind of false flag mission that's been done just now, something to try and stimulate a conflict. And he's shouting and bawling, and his advisors have got no answer for him, when all of a sudden somebody scurries in, gives a message, and it's silent. And he's in the other room, and he's thinking, I wonder what's happening now. And then he's escorted back in. Well, we've got some news for you. Yes, there is a healer. And this is where you're going to find this healer. I beg your pardon? A royal dignitary, a dignitary from a superior nation, and you're now telling me I need to go with this address to find the guy? What kind of king are you? You not tell the guy to come here. Well, that's not what the passage tells us, is it? Because the passage, verse 8, when Elisha, the man of God, heard the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel. It's not even an option that Elisha is going to be coming to him. No, the man comes to Elisha. And then you have this entourage, as it were, coming to Elisha's tent or whatever it was that he was based. And you see the contrast between how Elisha lives and what's coming before him. And then you realize that this is the third step of this process of humbling. Because as he's waiting for this healer to come out, the healer doesn't come to see him. The healer just sends out this servant. Does he not know who I am? Does he not know that I am Naaman the Great? Has he got no comprehension of the influence that I can exert? Does he have no idea? Well, if that was going to be unwelcome, well, the fourth step in the humbling process was even more unwelcome, and that was the message itself. And the message itself was unwelcome, and it was not received well. It was classed as an insult. Now, I know that some of you have been to the River Jordan, and you'll know that you're not quite looking at the nice, clear water of the River Ness. It's a slightly different ballgame that you're thinking of there. But nonetheless, he's been given this direction to go and wash seven times. But as far as he's concerned, this is an insult. Because surely, as he goes on to tell us in the passage from verse 11 onwards, surely he's going to come out and he's going to do something spectacular. He's going to say certain words and he's going to perform certain actions, and I'm going to be able to see and to hear what he said. And then on the basis of that, I'm going to be transformed. But no, he's sending me off to wash in this filth. What's my life come to? And then step five, he's having to listen to yet more servants. One servant has got him into this position, as he says it. The other servants, when he's throwing the strop, are having to come to him and tell him to just calm the head. If he told you to go and climb all of the Munros in Scotland, you'd have gone to do it. He's now telling you to go and dip seven times in a river. Just go and do it. And so here you have this man from all of the power and pleasantness of his life, going in and out of the filth of the River Jordan as he is learning that he needs to be humbled before God. This humbling process goes alongside the process of him being made very aware that the power that's going to cleanse him is not a power that resides in the fingertips of Elisha. It's a power that resides ultimately in God himself. And so for Naaman, he has to have this almost complete reorientation of all that was significant in his life, whether that is things that he gloried in, whether it was his country, whether it was his status, his achievements, his influence, all of that. And this crisis point in his life has given him nothing. And he's dipping in and out of the River Jordan seven times. And I wonder if that whole humbling process is something that sounds familiar. I wonder if some of us in here can look back and see, well, actually, in many ways, although the steps might have been slightly in a different order, that's exactly what took place, because life was going our way. We were ruling in control, and then all of a sudden, everything that I thought was secure was not. And all of a sudden, things that I had dismissed beforehand, I had to start thinking seriously about. And all of a sudden, the reality of what I was like began to be revealed gradually to me. For some of us, this whole humbling process for Naaman is a challenge. Because for some of us, we're maybe still at that position where we still think we're in control and our influence and our status counts for something. Well, we're still in that position where we think everything's hanging together just fine. And the whole notion of being humbled like this man, well, that's a very unwelcome prospect. And yet that's what actually has to happen. Because, you see, the Bible tells us that we're very similar to Naaman, not because of this infectious skin disease that would be fatal back in that generation, but actually that there's another disease that is fatal. And in some ways, it has similarities to leprosy. The Bible talks about leprosy specifically in Leviticus chapter 13, and it talks about how it spreads and how it defiles and how it isolates and how ultimately it destroys. And yet there is that sense in which the contamination of sin does exactly the same thing. and sin we are thinking of rejecting and ignoring God and the world he has created, not being or doing what he has commanded for us in his law. And sin is something that spreads. It's not confined to one part of our life. We would like to try and compartmentalize things, don't we? And we can't do that because sin just, it infects everything. It's total. It spreads, it defiles, it isolates, and ultimately it destroys. And so you and I, therefore, are carrying around by nature and building on what we carry around by nature by practice, we're carrying around this deadly disease. And there is only one way that this disease can be dealt with. There is only one way in which cleansing can be secured, and it's not actually in what seems to be the default of the human race throughout history, that we decide what's going to somehow make us acceptable before God. And some of us perhaps will maybe try to amend our ways and just change our life ever so slightly, and charitable living will become more of a thing, and giving of our time and our talents will be more of a thing. And for other folks, it will be maybe slightly more religious rituals that we'll go through. And there may be things like church, and there may be things like serving in different ways. And all of this is designed in some ways to ensure that there's something that we can offer in the light of what we've done. As if we're saying to the Creator, God, who knows us from the inside out, well, actually, there is this way, and surely this way is significant, because you can't really ignore this, can you? Whereas, as Naaman found out, there was no other way. There was no other way for him to know the cleansing and the healing transformation of God other than going into that place. And for us, there is no cleansing and healing transformation of God other than going to that other place, which seems even more unlikely to benefit than dipping into a river seven times. Because if that seems almost crazy, and why would clear-thinking individuals imagine that would somehow work, then in one sense, is it not even more bizarre for us to be brought back time and again from different parts of the Bible, from the whole message of the Bible, brought back time and again to a dark place, to a place where filth was present, where the filth that was present was actually our filth poured over one who was willing to absorb that filth and to pay the penalty for that filth? Because if it seems crazy for folks that Naaman, and it seemed bonkers to him at the time to go in and out of this river, how much more for us to be looking back to a cross 2,000 years ago, to an event that if we'd seen it, we'd close our eyes, we'd look away, because it's a scene of horror. And yet, this is what the Bible is telling us, that this scene of horror is partly what we have caused. And yet this scene of horror, understanding what takes place there, is where life and cleansing is to be found. This is the way. This is the way of God's cleansing. Somebody put it in this way, that everybody has the privilege of going to heaven God's way. Everyone has the privilege of going to heaven God's way or going to hell their way. Because we're not the ones who are deciding the remedy. It is God who does that. And for us, we don't go to the River Jordan. But for us, there is a cleansing that's needed. And that's a cleansing that Jesus speaks about in John chapter 13. In John 13, we've got one of these great passages where we're convicted about how we view ourselves as opposed to others. And you've got that awkward scene where they're sitting down and yet there's feet that have to be washed. And then disciples are looking around and going, well, there's no chance I'm going to do that. You know, surely it must be Matthew's turn or where is Judas? Surely it's Judas's turn to do this. And then Jesus steps up and he takes this towel and he starts performing this menial task, washing the filth and the dirt off their feet. And he comes to Peter, and Peter says, no, enough's enough, you're not doing that for me. No, I need to wash you, and unless I wash you, you could no part with me. Well, wash me all over, don't just wash my feet. And Jesus was going on to say, well, you know, those who've had a bath, those who've been cleansed, those who've come to him by faith and have experienced that transformation, that it is in that sense that that daily cleansing of our feet that we go back to with that confession of our sin for daily cleansing. Because cleansing is what's needed. Cleansing is what's needed for what lies deep below the surface. Cleansing from sin is found in Jesus Christ. And to be found in Jesus Christ, human nature being what it is, humility is what needs to be learned for us to come and to begin this life of faith, to see ourselves as God sees us. But here's the thing. Humility is what is required to continue the life of faith. That humility is not something that we show to get into the club, as it were. But humility is what we show in our lives on a day-to-day basis, because we remember the one who described himself as having a heart that is gentle and humble. The one who lived that humility, the one who deserved the adoration and the adulation, and yet he was the one who's willing to wash the feet of the disciples. He's the one who's willing to not to be served, but to serve. And so the life of faith begins as we are humble to see ourselves as God sees us, and we throw ourselves on his mercy. But the life of faith continues where humility is this core component of our lives. And so it was Hudson Taylor. He was a man who was called to be a missionary in China. And through his work, a team of 600 missionaries went to China to tell them of the good news. And he said that God used me because I was weak enough. What a remarkable statement that is. Not because I was smart enough, not that I was good enough. God used me because I was weak enough. Because he then goes on to say, he teaches someone to be quiet enough, to be little enough, and then God uses him. You see, humility, as Naaman was learning, is a prerequisite to coming to a faith in God. And humility, as Naaman will learn as the years go by, in the same way that you learn and I learn as the years go by, is a requirement to the life of faith continuing. And so this evening, having begun thinking about Naaman, next time we gather on a Sunday when I'm here, we'll think about what happened in the transformation of Naaman and how that began to impact with Elisha's servant, Gehazi. We're going to leave it there for the moment.